Hey everybody, welcome to Becoming Ultra. I got another interview today for you guys. This is Liza Howard. She's a good friend that runs this band of runners. She's a coach as well, doing a lot of really cool things for veterans in the community. And she's got done running Badwater, and the story's pretty crazy. That race is just nuts. So I wanted to catch up with her. Hope you guys enjoy that conversation here in a second. A couple things. BecomingUltra.com. I've been working my butt off to do a redesign of the website, so it is finally live. And specifically, I'd love you guys to check out the run camps. They're a really good way to subsidize all the efforts that we and I put into this effort over the last 7 years. And getting people in person in these beautiful places is such a passion. So check them out. We got a Rocky Mountain one in Salida, Colorado for the end of September. We've got one in March out in Palisade, Colorado on the Western Slope in March. And then what I'm really excited about is in February, we've got one in Costa Rica. Hillary Allen's going to be with me on all three of these. We're partnering up on some of the stuff to see if we can't grow this part of the brand and the business. And it's just really, really rewarding. So check that stuff out. If you don't have time, check that out. Patreon.com/becomingultra is where you can support the podcast and allow us to keep the stuff free. So thanks a lot, and hope you guys enjoy the show with Liza. Hey everybody, what's up? Scott Jones here with my buddy Liza Howard. We're going to chat all things Badwater today. The training. She's going to do a little outline of the race and what it means and what that thing is. I'm going to be talking to a few people that ran that course this year just to get some different perspectives and, you know, same goal as always, like just show people what is actually possible. If you put your mind to it, if you train for it and you have the right people around you, the right support system, how many cool things we can do with our bodies. So, Liza, what's up? How you doing?
I am doing great. So good to talk to you.
So, you know, a lot of times me and you hop on, we've been buddies for 6-7 years now, which is kind of crazy. And I just assume people know you because I know you so well. But why don't you just take a second, just introduce yourself. What do you do? Where are you from? Let people kind of get to know a little bit about you. That'd be kind of a good way to start this thing.
Let's see. So I am down in San Antonio, Texas. I have been running ultras for a good long while now, mostly like for many decades, mostly 100-mile races. I also coach with Ian Sharman's group, and I've been doing that for many, many years now as well. I teach wilderness medicine for Knowles Wilderness Medicine, so I get to travel around doing that. It's practicing basic first aid in really austere environments. And is that all I do? I run and I direct a band of runners. We bring military veterans into the trail running community. And so, yeah, that's what I've been doing. And I've always wanted to run Badwater since I started ultra running, because it seems, well, that's not true. At first, like most, like, you know, it's kind of the, with Badwater, there's this common story of people hear about it. It's this 135-mile race that goes from Death Valley, the lowest point in the U.S., up to the base of Mount Whitney. Mount Whitney is the highest point in the continental U.S. And so most people hear about that and they're like, well, that sounds horrible, because it's like, you know, in the 120s up to, you know, like it's crazy there. They do run it in July, so it's really nice and hot on the road. And so most people hear about that and they're like, I would never want to do such a thing. And so that was me. And then I went out there to crew. And then you drink the Kool-Aid and it's a beautiful, and then you want to do it. It's a beautiful place out there. It's just gorgeous, in a way that really austere environments are. Like, it's just, there's nothing there besides the land, and you can see forever, and it's just gorgeous. And so, yeah. And then it's a quirky community. It's like, you know, one of the branches of the trees in ultra running, like, it's its own little unique family, and folks are wonderful. And the way it works is that you run and you have a support vehicle aiding you the entire way, and so it'll drive up like every mile or 2 miles or less if you're having a really hard time, and they'll come out and they'll spray you down with water and refill your ice and give you whatever you want. It's like this little mobile aid station that's just yours, and you have up to 4 people in a minivan following you along, helping you out. And so it becomes this adventure with your good friends, because you can't do it by yourself. I mean, well, technically you can, but not in this race. And so like when you finish, it's, you know, your whole group has finished. And so it really feels like an awesome team event. So yeah, I don't even remember what your question was, Scott.
No, that's a perfect start. Just who you are. You did that pretty well. And diving right into to Badwater and just a brief description. Of course, you guys can look it up online and see what it looks like and see what the terrain looks like and kind of the history of the race. And I think it's a pretty polarizing event. You kind of said that ever since you started running ultras, you want to do that. And I'm like, ever since I knew what it was, it sounded like the furthest thing that I would ever want to do. So I think people probably either feel that way or don't, you know?
Yeah, and then you go out and crew, like I said, and you're like, oh yeah, this is pretty great. So
I can see it.
it's true.
Well, I just got off a call with some of the Becoming Ultra runners from the season, Ellie Greenwood's clients and runners, Natalie, who's out in LA area. She drove out to Death Valley with her friends, and she said that they thought they were just going to go see stuff, but she secretly wanted to drive the course because she saw you guys running a couple weeks ago.
Oh wow.
So she was in the basin, and it was like 125 or something like that degrees. And then they went up a little bit, and she's like, "Oh, it's so much cooler here." And she looked at her thing, and it was like 101 or something like that. And it's just kind of wild. And until you're there, you can't get your head around that kind of dry heat. It's pretty wild. It's pretty nuts. So I thought that was cool, and it is beautiful. And there are some unique parts of it for sure. So
I
how do
have
you get?
not sold you on it. I can tell. It's fine.
Well, here's what you got to understand about me. Like, I grew up in South Florida, and
Yes.
I never ran more than 2 miles my whole athletic career. I was playing baseball, basketball, football, and the only reason I ever ran 2 miles was, basketball, on average, you run 4 to 6 miles in a game in basketball. Like, you're running a lot, but you don't have to focus on the heat. Even if you're playing outside, you're focusing on the ball, and there's just a different mentality to it. But I went back last week, and I was like, "Oh, this is why I live in Colorado." I mean, it was pretty immediate. I'm
No, I'm with
mentally tough enough to go run long distances in heat, and like my body reacts to heat usually pretty good. But I just I don't know. I think it's the if you're working, okay. If you're going for a run, if you're working out, and then you're sweating your face off, that's one thing. If you're trying to sit and sip on a cup of coffee at 8 in the morning and you can't stop sweating, that's the other side of the coin for me.
No, I hear you. I feel like Florida is much worse than Death Valley.
Florida's rough,
Because
man.
of the humidity, right? Like I do, like I mean, I think that I'm not saying that it's not horribly hot and hard, but it's a different kind of it's a little bit of a different kind of suffering, Scott, and it's a little bit more pleasant.
Hey, so I wanted to ask you this. I'm gonna ask you so many like personal, quirky, weird
Okay,
questions about
excellent.
it. And so I think for this chat too, we'll just bounce back and forth between the event and the training because I have so many questions for you. But we went to Costa Rica this year, and in the last morning, me and Lauren went for a little run before we hopped on the plane, and it's muggy there too for sure, and it's pretty warm. And so you know what that feels. You know humidity. It's just like that heat's just around your face, so hot around your face, and you feel like you can never cool down. But you got the moisture. So then the next day we get to Colorado, and it was like 95, 96, 97, 98. It was high 90s, dry as a bone. And I went for a run, probably like a 5 miler, and it felt like I was smoking a pack of cigarettes because it's so dry out. And like just keeping the back of your throat kind of moist so you're not choking on yourself. Could you tell that difference too? Like the dry heat affects my like around my mouth, my face, and the breathing part. The humidity is just uncomfortable everywhere, though, you know?
No, the dry heat, the dryness of the air got me in trouble actually at Badwater because it was so dry, my mouth was so dry that I ended up drinking more water than I usually do. And I knew I was drinking more, but like it's 117, you know, like when we started or so around there, and you're like, it's fine, you know, like what's 8 extra ounces, you know, no big deal. But you know, hours after hour after hour of that, and so I overdrank, and so I got hypernatremia and got super, super sick, and so, so yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. It's so hard. And you know, what you're supposed to do is just like, you know, drink your normal amount and then you like kind of swish the water around and spit it out and not drink the extra because it's not that you're thirsty. It's just that, you know, your oral
I don't
mucosa are
feel.
so dry. But you know, it's hard to think after a number of miles.
That's interesting. So that's why my next question was. So the common knowledge is just get that moisture in your mouth and spit it out and just continue to do that, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people will do like they'll either do that, and kind of it'll give you a sense of whether am I really thirsty or is it just that like everything's so dry, right? And if you just get it wet, some people will suck on candy, you know, just because it'll keep it moist. Some folks chew gum. I feel like I would choke if I did that for sure. Like it seems like a bad idea,
Just
but I
eating
know
a
a lot of
giant
people
lemon
do
head
it.
on the just a giant lemon head
Right,
on
exactly.
the
But yeah, like that, just because it's so easy to confuse being thirsty with just being dry and overdrink out there. So
is there any way to keep the moisture around your mouth? Like, do people use buffs and stuff with some moisture? Does that help, or is that just suffocate feel like it's suffocating you even more in that dry heat?
just feel like you're suffocating even more. The only reason folks would do that if it is if it was windy and there was, you know, sand and stuff, because there
Yeah.
have been sandstorms and stuff like that out there, which is a
Yeah.
whole nother level. And apparently there have been locusts out there.
Really?
Race director Chris Crossman was like, yeah, one year we had locusts. And so I told my crew, I was like, if there are any biblical plagues during the run, I'm out. Like that's my
Yeah,
I'm
me.
done.
Yeah. That's my DNF list.
Yeah,
Biblical
I'm like
plagues and choking on candy. That's what usually gets people out of races, guys, if you're new to ultra running. Yeah, we were driving out to San Diego last March, and we were like on that long, dreadful stretch between Vegas and California before there's anything. It's very similar to a lot of the scenery from Death Valley, like, and we ran into a huge sandstorm. It was a wall. It was like from Mummy, the movie, you know. And I was like, holy crap, the visibility is like probably 20 yards, and it's like a brown snowstorm. But I was thinking about you guys who run that race and if that ever happened before, because how in the heck, how do you deal with that? That's they take a while to move through sometimes too. I don't know how people would deal with it. You just goggle up and buff up or
That's what
what?
happened last year. Last year they started in a haboob. And so yeah, the folks who had goggles fared a lot better, you know, and yeah, and people were covering up dust, but I think that took a lot of people out of last year's race just because it was running into this headwind, and folks not being able to, one, kind of exert themselves, you know, they were exerting themselves so much more than they thought they would have. And the park has put a pretty tight li time limit on the first cutoff, and so a lot of folks had some trouble making that, from what I understand.
Brutal. All right, for
Yeah.
people who are like kind of following along with results, because you could see posts and stuff on the website, there's always a handful of people that quit really, really early on in the race. And in my opinion, like with any athletic endeavor, like I never feel any negative feelings towards those people, because they got to the start line and they were going to try to figure it out. So what's something you could say for people who don't understand maybe the sport or that? Oh my gosh, my dog's barking his face off. Or that exact race where, 1 second, let me get this dog real quick. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, I'll edit that out. Yeah, so what I was saying is, how do you, what kind of, for somebody who finished the race, what is something that people could understand that even if they had to bail out in the first 15 miles, which happens, why is that okay? Why is that reasonable? Like, how can we relate to that being something that happens for someone who's trained for a long time for that event? Because it happens every year.
Yeah, and that's a good question. I mean, like, I think it comes down to why somebody's doing a race in this instance that's so long. There's a high finishing rate at Badwater because it is hard to get in.
Right.
You do have to, you know, run some races beforehand. So most people coming in, you know, kind of have a sense of how to take care of themselves. It's expensive. You're asking a lot of, like for your training, you're asking a lot of your family and friends when you're doing that training. And then you're asking a lot from 3 to 4 people who have come out to, I guess, 2 to 4 people who have come out to help you and taken all this time off. And so that keeps a lot of people in. So you don't have a lot of the dropping that you do in ultras where there's not kind of the negative consequences to other people aren't as
Yeah.
great, you know? I think that a lot of times early on, it sounded like when I was talking to Chris a little bit that it was stomach issues that were issues for folks. And I think that one of the nice things about a race like Badwater, and I'll say this in general in races, that if like the stomach is usually not a reason that it will derail your race in a way that you can't recover from. Like
Yeah.
usually if you get really nauseated, you vomit and all this other stuff, like it's an issue because maybe now you can only hike because you can't take any food in, and now you can't hike fast enough to make cutoffs. But in a lot of races, you sure can, and that's certainly the case in Badwater, and that's what I did. Like I vomited my guts out and then some while at mile 80, and after that, I couldn't take in anything without retching, and so I hiked for the next 50 miles, 55 miles, and didn't eat. And you can always hike without eating. And I think that sometimes when people drop, and I know this isn't quite where you were going with the question, but it's just been on my mind. I think that sometimes when people drop because of their stomach, it's just a lack of experience and understanding that if you just give yourself some your stomach some time,
Yeah.
like it'll recover. You just got to stop shoving stuff in there. And then you can hike without any food at all. Like you don't need food to hike,
Yeah, especially well, for those long ones, when you have all that time, when you have so much leniency on the time, like give yourself the time. I mean, sit there and figure it out for a while. That makes sense.
Yeah, like and that's the nice thing about having a real experienced crew is that they can just tell you that. You're like, you're fine. Just don't eat. Go hike. Like we'll see in a little while,
Were you getting any
I think
nutrition
people
at
get
that
freaked
point?
out.
Were you getting
What's
any
that?
for the last 55? Were you getting any nutrition at all? Just water?
No, I had a cup. No, couldn't take any water because like so I would suck on ice. And I'd like chew it just a little bit and like some would dribble down my throat and then I just let the rest out of my mouth. I'm sure there are some really gorgeous pictures of me on
Oh my gosh.
the
Drooling.
out there from the race. Yeah, I just couldn't like I would just retch. Like I think I tried to drink some soda and that was a no-go. And so I hiked and yeah, like I said, like I feel like I've proven again and again that yeah, you don't need calories to hike,
So you think people just, for whatever reason, their expectations were not set correctly if they're bailing for that reason early on?
I think that maybe they hadn't figured out how to fuel themselves in the heat, maybe.
Yeah.
And because that's a hard thing to do, especially if you don't live in a hot environment, right? Like, because it's not like you can get better at the heat, like by doing sauna training and all that stuff. But if you're not actually running in it, it's kind of hard to add that fueling component in. But sometimes too, it's just crewing issues out there. Like I know, Chris had said like one person dropped pretty early because their crew was just confused and ended up like going far ahead. And you need your crew there. And so sometimes it's that kind of issue.
Yeah, there could be some emotional outbreaks off of the frustrations of that become more interpersonal than actually physical, I think. That happens a
Oh
lot.
yeah, for sure.
I crewed down in Habanero a few years ago. I've told you this story so many times, but oh my. So it was a client who's a good friend and like, but her crew, all novices. They'd never even been to an ultra before. And that's not any ultra, but especially 195 degree heat in the middle of summer in Texas. You want to have some experience and people who know when to push you and all that stuff. And yeah, I mean, me and my buddy's a runner too. And he'd been around crew type stuff. And we kind of just took over because you're like, there's first sight of stress. A lot of people are going to back off. I think Badwater is so unique because I mean, safety is a huge issue out there, and being smart with your body and stuff. But you had some freaking pros out there too. Training wise, I know how much you're training, and I have a couple questions for you. When you started training for Badwater, you're kind of like me with social media. Like, it's necessary, but you and me could easily go live on a mountain and never talk to anybody ever again.
It's true.
It doesn't seem like that because we have, we work, and but But you start posting a lot. Where did that come from? Was that you? Did somebody tell you you need to? Is a little both? Like, I'm kind
Oh no, nobody told me. I don't think I'd do it if somebody told me to
of.
do
I know.
it. Be
That's
like,
just because
no,
you,
I
it was
just,
like, oh, it's fun.
no, I posted every day except one night I fell asleep like with my phone on my chest, like with the Instagram open to post. I think that was the only time I didn't post for like half a year. Yeah, I decided I was gonna do it. And I was like, well, like this is gonna be this big thing that I'm doing. And whenever anybody does something big and they're not a full-time athlete, I think it's fun. Like it can be, I don't want to use the word inspiring, but that it can be useful to other folks to see like how maybe it's possible to do it or how that, well, I always feel like for me, I'm like posting them and people are like, well, if this wreck of a human can manage to get this done and do this long race, then certainly, I can too. And so, and also, Instagram, I don't look at Instagram very much because I just find it depressing. But like it's just people are running in these just gorgeous places and they look so beautiful. And so I just felt like I could do a service by like posting all the ugly places that I was running looking horrible.
Yeah, no, it's huge.
And that, like that was pretty fun to lean into, I have to say. And then it was, and then like I would never look at how many people were liking it, but I had this little thing, so it would pop up when somebody did like it. And so I didn't have the pressure of like, oh, like not many people like today, but it was kind of this nice thing where it would pop up like, oh, look, it just made somebody happy. And so, yeah. And so, I am going to get back to it, Scott, because I heard that it was useful for a couple of people. And so I was like, well, I have plenty more ugly pictures in me. And I have to, and I'm going to be running some ugly places. And so, and then I had, and then I came up with some new plans. And so I'm going to start up again.
Well, I loved that. That was really cool. One of my favorite ones that you posted was about and this feels like me, not just with training for athletic things, it feels like me with like entrepreneurial stuff and all my business and work stuff and my wife. We're very similar. But the whole idea of like, you know what? If the house is a mess, I don't really give a shit. Like nobody's gonna die because there's some clothes on the floor. And as long as it's sanitary and we can straighten it up pretty quick, as long as we can throw everything in the closet before people come over, I'm good to go. Because we've always had this joke, me and Lauren have, that if we die and our house is spotless, then we have failed as human beings. And there's a lot of really clean people out there that are gonna hate that comment, and a lot of MC people. But that's like like okay, we could go hike on that mountain that I can see out the window right now, or I can go scrub the floors. What do you think is going to happen? You know? And so what was your experience and if you want to kind of paraphrase your mindset at the time, because I think a lot of people have a hard time with balancing things they want to do and things they have to do. And maybe they're categorizing things they have to do, when they really don't have to do them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think, like it's all these trite things that turn out to be like really true and powerful, right? Like, so I decided like this things were necessary for me to be able to accomplish this and do it without with the minimal amount of suffering. And then I just like scheduled them, like I was like, well, I need to the like this is the minimum that I need to do in order to not suffer hugely, and I just put them down. And then, but like Scott, I would schedule things like, read with the kids 30 minutes a day, like so I would have other important things in there too. And then I just put it on a big chart, and it was super satisfying to be like, mark that off, mark that off. And yeah, I had all these little spreadsheets and stickers and a couple of colorful markers. Yeah, and so I think that, for everybody, it's just figuring out. I think it works really well to just figure out like how much time am I willing to commit to this thing that I want to do, and then go from there. And really thinking about like how much time am I spending with my family in a good way, and how much time am I willing to put into this thing. And then it's kind of fun to just parcel up then like okay, well, I have 2 hours a day, or I have 90 minutes a day, or I have half an hour a day. Like how am I going to use it?
Well, I just texted with a buddy who just had his first kid, and we all have these conversations with people after they ha have kids. And this is not to put people who don't have kids out, because we all have different priorities and responsibilities and stuff. But the one thing that you do realize pretty early on is that your time is no longer yours. You do not own your time the same way you did before. And he sent me all these nice messages, like, "Hey, I really respect your work ethic. I'd never realize," you know, like just really nice messages from somebody who at least understood like my lifestyle and how I do things.
Right.
And no, I just think it's hugely important when you have to really manage your time. And we both manage people's time for a living too, so.
And just learning what, and like realizing that you have to let go of certain things, like my house. Like I like how you said sanitary, and I was kind of like sanitary, in quotes. Like yeah, this is not. It is. When people come over, it definitely does feel like, oh God, like shove things places and wipe some stuff off. But yeah, that can't happen. Like there, I do not have another hour during the day to mop and shine and that. And so, and that was kind of hard. That for me was hard to let go of because it is this, facade,
That's what's good
and
about
to let
living
people be
rurally.
like,
Nobody, if somebody comes,
nobody's
they
coming
have to tell us they're coming
over.
because it's a hall form. So in the time that my
Get
friends
some
can get here,
time.
I have an hour at any given time. But I will say, for the record, I've been to your house a few times, and I don't know if I told this story. I told this story to you, but I don't know if I told it on the podcast last time we talked. But I've had a chance to snoop around in your bathroom a little bit because last time I was there, we're about to go to the Band of Runners camp, which is about an hour away from hour or two away from your house. I forget how far. And I get there and I look in my suitcase. I was like, holy shit, I forgot my freaking sleeping
That's
bag, which
right.
is the first thing on the list. And I was like, I'm not going to freeze. It's not that cold out there, but I need something at night or else I will get chilly. So I snuck around and I found a little fleece throw in your closet in your bathroom and I stashed it. And I didn't tell you until afterwards because I knew you wouldn't care, but I thought it was hilarious that I stole a blanket from you just to stay warm out there, and it was very fun. See, it was more than sanitary. It was clean. Good
So
job.
what's hilarious though is that was the dogs.
I know. That's appropriate, dude.
I would have given you a nicer one. Yeah, but I mean, I think like that's the one of the wonderful things about having children. It is this process of recognizing that, yeah, your time is not your own and you have to let go of things. It's this process of like letting go of things that you thought were very important and in a good way, right? Like, yeah, cleaning the house is not going to be the priority. And that's different for everybody, for sure. But if I want to do these other things, then I'm going to have to let go of some stuff. So,
Well, it kind of goes back to your to last 50 miles of bad water. You had to come to the conclusion that you're not going to be able to have the same comfort that a normal race would have, and it is what it is. And you just kind of move forward. And you let it go. You're not putting food in your mouth because it's not staying there anyway. And it's just that mentality. And I think, running far distances and doing hard endurance efforts teaches you a lot of stuff that translates over to real
right.
life, which is cool.
One more time-wise example, it's either you're going to look good on your run, like spend some time with your outfit, or you're going to go run. Like it's only two, one of those two things is happening, not both.
You know what's funny? So you said Instagram's depressing because people run in beautiful places. And one of the reasons I can feel it myself. Like one of the reasons I don't post as much is because I feel like, because I live in a beautiful place, dude. I feel like it could make people depressed in a way, and
Need
that's
to
stupid.
Photoshop you into my neighborhood sometime.
Yes. I got enough pictures from Florida last week to depress anybody.
Okay, there you go. You're good. Okay,
But
yeah.
I feel that too, and it's like even though the place, the scenery is beautiful and all that stuff, like the way you feel isn't always awesome. Like I don't
Right.
always feel good
Yeah,
when I
no,
go on
for
a
sure.
run, all those things. But so I get kind of gun shy on the other end of the spectrum, which is probably just as dumb, but it's interesting. Like social media is interesting because we get to see every aspect of the people if we want to. Hey, so back to the training. So what
Okay.
give me two or three things that really, really you think helped you get to the finish line of that thing. Yeah, go for it.
I had a bad hamstring injury that caused me to drop from a race in December. And so I had to configure my training so that my hamstring would heal. And so I ended up running every other day. Like I played around a lot with like, oh, how could I run little so I wouldn't exacerbate it? And it turned out it just needed a full rest day. And so I just ran every other day. And so some days that was ended up being 4 times a week. Sometimes it would be 3 times a week, just every other day. And that worked great. And so the days were longer than they would have been, which I think worked out well for Badwater. I increased my volume a bunch more than it had been in, I think, ever. And so I got up to around 90-ish miles a week, which I know, and some people run a lot more than that, but I tend to break after about mile 80. And so that was real important. Badwater is really hilly. It's not a flat race. You go over two mountain ranges and then up Mount Whitney. And so I did a lot of hill repeats because we just don't have long hills to play around with here. And so I just would go, half a mile up the hill and half a mile down, half a mile up and half a mile down. I did a ton of that. I probably should have added some weight to my back for those so that the pounding would be more. But like I've plumbed the depths of my commitment to my sport, and it like wearing a weight vest when it's like 100 degrees outside, I just
Brutal.
couldn't do it. Yeah. And so there was that. And then for Badwater too, the heat acclimation is huge. And so it's hot here in San Antonio, but it's mostly in the 90s or a little bit above 100, and which is not 117, 120, 125. And so I did a bunch of sauna training. And so it seems like you really only need to get for the physiological adaptations to be in there about 30 minutes. But I ended up doing a lot of 45 minutes because it was really hard. And I just like, I would get anxious and I felt like I needed the mental training of staying for those extra 15 minutes and just dealing.
Yeah.
And so I did that
What temperature did
for.
you run your the sauna?
It was the Lifetime Fitness people who decided what temperature it would be. And usually it was about like 170, 180.
Nice.
So,
That's legit.
yeah. And I would go super early so that no one would be there. Because I was like, I'm going to get COVID in the sauna sitting with these people. And then I'd get really mad because, like, when I would have to go midday and there were more people who would come in. Because they just seem so damn cheerful. They would come in and they're just like sitting there and they'd be in like a lot of clothes. Like they'd be in like leggings or like some zip up hoodie or whatnot. And I was like, I became like the troll of the sauna. I would just be like, why are you in here? I didn't say it out loud, but that's what I would. And then they would, be listening to their phones or whatever because they were only going to stay like maybe 10 minutes, 5, 10 minutes. And so their phones wouldn't die. So I'm like in the corner of the sauna, like next to the heating element. Like I'm a like a river is running down me of sweat. Like I've got a little lake of sweat around me. I'm a disaster. And they're like cheerfully listening to their music, all boppy. And then they get out and they'd open the door and leave. And there'd be this like little bit of cool air would come in and I try and catch it all. And
Did you
yeah,
listen to anything,
anyway.
or did you just try to embrace it?
No, I couldn't because the phone would overheat and I could have brought like a little ice pack in there and put the phone on it and all this stuff, but it was just too much. I was just like, I was like, I'm just gonna go in and sit there. And I think it was good because it's harder obviously not to be distracted, right? And so it was good to just kind of sit there and have to deal with being that hot.
Did you exert yourself at all in the sauna, or you just sit?
No, I just sat. I felt like for me it's hot enough and it was hot enough in San Antonio while I was running.
Yeah.
And there is a bit of this balance of like and also like it was hot enough in the sauna. I didn't need to do squats or whatever to
Yeah.
like make it work. So yeah.
That's funny. The last time I was in the sauna, this is such a funny story. Last time, it was when I lived in town, probably 3 years ago, right before COVID. I go in, and I didn't go in very often, and for the same reasons as you, like, 'cause small talk's great, right? No, it's not, by the way. So I go in, and there's these two older guys, like probably in their mid-50s. One is a really hefty guy, and one's a thinner guy. And the hefty guy, he's really animated. He's talking with his hands, and then he's working out. But his workout is like he's moving his arms like this. I'm just moving my hands over my head, like at a concert. And then he'd like do air push-ups. But and then he's dancing, dude. And that was his workout, right? And then so this other guy, the other older guy who came in about 3 minutes after I was in there. So this guy starts talking to him and they have a 10-minute conversation. I have my head down. I'm not talking to any of these people. And this guy's telling him about his business and the church he's trying to start out of his house and feels very cultish and goes through this whole thing. And he extend the bigger guy extends his hand and says, "Hey, I'm Doug." I forgot his name. He's like, "Yeah, I know. You introduced yourself yesterday. You've already told me all this." And then the guy gets up and
Oh
walks out. The other guy.
no.
So then it's just me and the guy who's introduced
Oh.
himself.
Doug.
And then he starts pitching his church idea to me and asks if I've met God and all this stuff. And I don't have any feelings on that for the podcast, but it was just like, I think he was just going in there and he was literally every single person that was in there. He's trying to get them to come to his house
Wow.
church. So yeah, that pushed me away from the sauna for a while.
That was the end of your, yeah.
That was the end
Yeah,
of
I
it.
didn't have that. I mostly like, it was so hot outside, like 103 or whatever. Like sometimes when I was in there, when I couldn't go early in the morning, I just wanted to be like, why aren't you people outside? Like, why come in here? Like who told you this was a good idea?
Yeah.
Because they're wrong. No, I don't, whatever. I'm sure.
Hey, so when you're research, I'm sure you did a little research on sauna stuff and heat acclimation. You know more than I do because you had a really strong reason to understand some of the stuff. So, from your understanding, what are some of the main benefits in acclimating besides just being comfortable with feeling that heat for long periods of time? Like, did you dive into some of the physiological things and how temperature mattered and decide how long you wanted to stay in there and where the law of diminishing returns happened? Just some of that stuff would be interesting.
Yeah, it seems like the acclimation process is similar to acclimating to altitude, that it takes about, kind of 10 to 14 days to acclimate to that environment. So fun vocabulary word, when you're out in a hot environment outside and you're getting better at being in that environment, it's called acclimatization. When you're simulating the hot environment, it's acclimation.
And I've
So take
always gotten
that.
those two wrong my whole freaking
I
career.
still do.
Wait a minute, I'm writing this
Yeah.
down. Say that again.
So
Acclimatization when you're
it's
outside.
acclimatization is outside, and acclimation is inside, or some simulation.
Okay, so climate is sounds like climate outside. Okay.
I don't know.
I don't know if I knew what those words meant before just now, just to be honest with you, because they're so interchangeably used. It's always been kind of confusing.
Yeah, no, I think most people, yeah, just use them, without knowing the correct term. It doesn't matter really, obviously. Just thought it's a fun little tidbit of that I gained in knowledge during my backwater training. Yeah, so it seems like one of the things that happen as you get better at dealing with the heat is one of the things that happens is you sweat more readily, right? So you're able to cool yourself down more quickly. And then the composition of your sweat changes. And so you're able to hold on to electrolytes better. Your heart rate will also be lower eventually as you get better with dealing with the hot environment. And so those adaptations happen. And it seems like when you're doing some sort of acclimation protocol, like going into a sauna, that it takes about 30 minutes for about 10 days, will get you about as acclimated as you're going to be to the environment that you're going to race in. There are different protocols. Well, there are different ideas about like when's the best time to do the acclimating processes. Traditionally, it's been kind of those 10 to 14 days right prior to the race. And then you don't do anything about maybe 3 days prior to the race because you don't want to be heat exhausted going into it. But Jason Koop is a big proponent of a protocol where you're doing some acclimation early on in your training, more like, 5 and 6 weeks out, and then just doing kind of hits of heat, every 3 days or so along the way, and then a little bit more closer towards the race, so that it's not affecting your training quite as much, right? Because that's the downside. Like, you can't really run as well because you're heat exhausted. Like, that's, from doing this. So that's what happens. And your plasma volume increases as well during this heat training, which is why it gets recommended for folks who are going
Altitude.
to be racing at altitude. Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of the big breakthrough research in the last 2 or 3 years. And you would see it all the time. Like I remember being up in Leadville and we were having lunch with this guy that we just met at the Packy Pickup. He's in Dallas and he was so worried about his race and he'd been running this heat all summer and dude killed it. I mean, he had no issues with the altitude because he'd been running that stuff all summer. The sw sweating more readily. I love that fact because working with a lot of athletes, in the gym setting, but then also outside and like, you have the people that say, "Oh, I just sweat so much, so fast." I was like, That's actually a good thing. I mean,
Right.
it's your body figuring out through so many trials that you need the sweat earlier to cool off earlier, and it's really important and kind of cool. I think the how your sweat changes to keep electrolytes is a really interesting physiological thing that happens as you adapt. And then I think also like the way that Coop was doing that protocol, keeping just the perceived effort changes as any increased fitness or change in physiology happens, you don't perceive that heat to be as much of a stressor, which is huge for something like Badwater or any of those really hot races. So I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, exactly. Yep, your perception of how horrible it is huge. Like, yeah, you're not going to be able to perform as well, like the more miserable you're finding it. And so that's a huge part of it as well. And that was why I stayed those extra 15 minutes in there to just try to make my peace with
Yeah,
it.
no, it's cool. I'm actually building the sauna at my house right now. There's this little shed on the property when we got up here, but it snows here, Liza. So I'm not doing it in summer, and it's a st
I hear you.
it's going to take me another 3 months because it's just like a fun project. But I'm going to see if we can make a little sauna action up here in the
Activated.
mountains. Pretty fun. All right, so th those are awesome tips from your training. So let's just kind of dive into the race. It's 135 miles. We're not going to talk about every mile. We'll both lose our minds by then, but
There
I
I
think
was, mile two.
I want to give you a chance to like give a shout out to your crew. So you guys shout out your crew because they're freaking amazing people to go do that. And you think you're difficult, you're not, but in your eyes, you're like, oh, they had to deal with me. And then just a kind of overview of your day out there. We kind of got the idea at the end, kind of sucked, and you had to hike a lot. But mentality going into it, I know the temperature was crazy. You guys started late at night. What it was like running at night versus day, how long it took, just dive in a little bit. I'd love to hear
Right. Well, I'd just like to start by saying my goal for this race was to go in there and understand how to become a more compassionate person, which I would like to just put out there to everyone, like that's a dangerous thing to hope for.
it.
During a race, it's gonna come back to bite you. I thought I might have some epiphany in the desert, but I'll tell you what actually happened.
Just came out hating everybody.
So the race starts at night now. The Park Service has mandated that. It's not that it's really like it doesn't make a huge difference, right? Because you're running for 135 miles, so you're still going to be running during the daytime, and you're still it's just where you're experiencing the heat is a little bit different. And so it starts in stages, and so it starts at 8, 9, 11. Is that right? 8, 9, 10? I don't know. I don't remember anymore. Anyway, it was late. I was like, how am I supposed to stay up this late? And so we start off and it's dark and you're running down the highway. And it was great. It was super fun. It was like, oh, it started finally. And everything was going really well, except that I told you I was drinking a little more water than I usually do. My crew. I had four crew members who were amazing. Ricky Harrow was my crew chief. I don't know that anybody knows more about crewing Badwater than he does. He was amazing. And then Megan Canfield, who's also my coach, was on my crew, and she is one of the loveliest, sweetest people who's out there. Rachel Ballard, who's a wonderful, wonderful friend, was there. She's also a child psychiatrist, so I felt like that would come in handy along the way.
I don't want to run anymore.
Exactly. You get out there, Liza. And then my friend Jeff was out there as well, helping and doing an exceptional job. So they jump out and they'd spray me down with water and give me treats. And I'd be on my way, and they'd go down 2 miles. Anyway, and so things were just lovely for a good while. And then because I drank too much water, I got to a point by mile 80 where I vomited so much, and then some more, and then I crawled into the back of the minivan, like not the way back because that was packed with gear and equipment, but like right behind the front seats and the back seats in that little space there, I like crawled in,
You do this
face
for
down on
every
the
hot race,
floor.
I've realized. You do
I
this in the
know, I
heat.
feel like I do. is like squished in between like cans of soda and stuff, and just laid there for a little while. And I looked up, and the four of them are standing at the door of the van looking in. And so here was the look of compassion on their faces was something I will never forget. And they were ready to do whatever was necessary to help their friend continue on. And I was like, damn it, I wish for compassion. And what I got was an example of compassion. Crap. Anyway, and so it was lovely and beautiful, and I will never forget it. And I hope to be able to give that to other people for sure. So with the compassion out of the way, I continued on, but I was no longer able to eat anything. And so they would just hand me like a little Dixie cup full of ice. Chew the ice, and like every mile they'd like try to offer me other stuff, but I'd be like, no, just ice. And so I just like hiked along, and I had brought a slushy machine with me, a shaved ice machine, and I had these wonderful goals of like having slushies along the way, and I didn't realize how hard that would be to make happen. And so there was just like a lot of them pouring unsweetened Kool-Aid powder into the ice because I didn't realize you had to put sugar in Kool-Aid. Like I'd forgotten that you have to add like so much sugar to Kool-Aid powder. And so they'd bring it out and I was like, oh God, what
Oh,
am I
that's
gonna
so
do?
awful.
And then they'd like add a little bit of sugar and they'd bring it out, but it was like brownies that are made with vegetables. I was like, what is this? This isn't sweet. And then they go back and it was just like I'd run up to the back of the van. This is still when I could eat. And they were like, all four of them are like looking at the like slushy machine trying to make this thing. And anyway, so apparently that was
You know,
quite an
they make
ordeal for
pre-made
them.
little juice. You just bleep.
Yeah, no, so if I go back. I'm definitely. But yeah, and so then it was kind of wonderful because I couldn't do, I couldn't run anymore, not being able to eat, but I could hike. And so then I just did a lot of hiking with my good friends and it was awesome. And I hiked and I hiked some more and then there was some more hiking. And then Badwater just has this exceptional finish where you come out of the desert and then it's like Mount Whitney, like straight in your face. And leading up to Mount Whitney, there are these gorgeous jaggedy peaks. And it's just such an awesome finish. You're like, I've done, like 126 miles, but wait, there's more. And it's just, up. And so yeah, so we made our way up and it was lovely and tears were shed. And then it was done. And then you could drive back down. And you drive back past all these people who are still coming up. And you do these calculations in your head during the race. You're like, okay, it's only, 13 more miles. And at this pace, oh God, so many hours to go. And so as you're driving down and seeing all these people coming up, you're like, oh God, you still
That's
have like
rough.
so much,
That's the power
so
of being
much.
present when you know like how slow you're going and how long you have left. And I remember
Yeah.
when there's years ago when Lance Armstrong like rode the Leadville 100, and he's Lance Armstrong. He finished pretty darn quick, and he there's a huge interview with him talking about like the people who are still on the course. He's like I can't. He's like, that course is so hard. I can't imagine being out there that much longer. And I'm sure,
Yeah.
the front of the Packers definitely feel that for the people that are struggling.
Yeah, because it gets real hot again,
But
and so it's like you're like, oh, there's more.
with all that compassion that you learned, I'm sure you hiked a few people up for the last 10 just to I'm just kidding. No, she did not.
I
You were
forgot. I was
sick.
too sick. Sorry. Yeah,
Yes, you
too
were
sick.
sick.
They had crews. They didn't need me.
Hey, what did you do to fix the hypernatremia besides rest and fluids and electrolytes? I mean,
There was nothing to do, just stop
yeah.
drinking water. Like that's the only treatment, right? Like you drank too much, stop it. I did like we did try some bouillon just to, because that's not the fix, right? It's just that you've had too much water. But sometimes like you can feel better when you drink, you take in some salty stuff. And so I tried, came right back up. I was like, oh, nope, no good. So yeah, I mean, I think that we talked about this, Scott. Like that's just a misunderstanding with hyponatremia is everybody thinks it's an electrolyte issue, and it's just you took too much water in, and so there's really
Yeah.
nothing to do. So yeah.
How long till you felt like a semi-normal person? I mean, you still put that effort on your body, so you're probably beat up a little bit there, but till your head was back,
Pretty quickly because I hiked for 50 miles. You know what I mean? Like so,
Yeah.
I wasn't beat up in the same way. And so yeah, so right afterwards, Pam Smith and I and Rachel, like, we drove out to Hard Rock to help out there, and then I got to do some hiking in the San Juans as well, and yeah, felt okay. So the take-home message is just hike. It's much better for you.
How long did the
Don't
whole
run.
race take you?
I don't know. I think
We could look it up.
33, 33-ish
33.
hours, maybe. I don't know. Like, the sleep, the lack of sleep was really hard. I haven't, I don't like being tired like that at all. And that was hard to deal with.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like, you know, like with kids, you're like, oh yeah, like, I'm so glad I'm through that bit, you know?
Well, we were just talking off air. I was telling you, like, the reason I hadn't put in for anything longer than 100K is because anything I did, I wanted to be able to sleep that same night, because for the early years of raising kids, you're at their disposal and you just never slept. So when you got back to sleeping, it's like, oh my gosh, this is the best thing ever.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, why am I doing this? But yeah, so.
All right, two more questions.
Okay.
Pam Smith, who I've met and at the camps and hung out with a bunch. I'm gonna have her on to kind of tell her story of this too. I was watching you guys. You guys are pretty close for most of the day out there, it looked like. But I guess she passed you eventually because she finished a little bit before you. So did you guys get a talk when she passed, or were you out of it when she passed you?
Oh, I think I was lying down in the bed when
Right.
she passed. But yeah, like, it's fun out there because you are around, you know, the same people for a long while, and so your vans are like leapfrogging along the way, and so like her crew would go by, and I get to wave at them, and you know, yeah, it was great.
Oh, that's awesome. And then, okay, back to the question. Your goal was to understand how to be more compassionate. You said you wouldn't recommend doing that race to figure that out, but did you have any big takeaways off of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, so on the one hand, I think that Badwater is such a fun race because it is a puzzle to figure out how to get the training's a puzzle, like figuring out how to do what you need to do, figure out what you need to do, and then how you fit it into your life. Like, that's hard. That's a big accomplishment. I think, like, I feel really proud. Like,
Yeah.
I did like all that I could for that race, and so that was super satisfying. But then it's the race itself is this fun puzzle, and like, I got that water drinking part wrong, and so it's fun to think about, like, okay, well, if I did, you know, I can fix that. That's like a pretty straightforward fix, you know. And it's not wanting to run faster necessarily. It's more kind of just wanting to get it right in that place, you know, like, it's this gorgeous place and it's such a cool event, and just wanting to get it right, you know, is really tempting. So I hope I get to go back eventually. But the other part, the compassion part, for sure, like, I do feel like I came out of that. Like, you can't run through a desert like that and not, you know, have some pretty profound thoughts. Well, I mean, I'm sure you can, but I was happy that I managed to have some good thoughts along the way. And I think that, you know, my crew just set that example of, like, how you want to be in life is you want to be like heart forward, ready to help people. And I think I came away with a better understanding of what that looked like and how to do that. And so that's busy. Now, Scott, I have not done anything since Battle
Yeah, you help
to
people.
help
Yeah, you do. You help people in
anybody.
Silverton. Well, I think one of the biggest things I've learned from aid stations and crewing, like we both have 1,000 stories on all of these kind of themes, is that you help people before they ask for it. And it's really hard to do that if you're not confident in yourself and you're not con and you don't know the situation and you don't know if you're gonna step on toes. But honestly, in so many different situations, like if you can just help before people are asking for it in real life and out on the trails and all these different aspects. That's what your crew did for you for hours out there in the desert. And it's something that I try to do and try to teach my boys, and it's a huge takeaway.
Yeah, like, you have to care about other people. I think that would, like, I mean, like, that's the
Yeah.
simplest way. Like, you should live your life caring about other people and not worrying about whether they care back. You know.
Oh, absolutely. All right, so a couple things. Band of Runners, bandrunners.org still, I believe. Check it out, people.
Yes, indeed.
I go down to Texas in November for the camp and go coach and help out and mentor wherever I can. Do some dishes. We all do lots of dishes. It's fun, and it's a really beautiful place to spend a long weekend. So check that out. And there's tons of ways you guys can support it. I always give a shout out when Liza comes on here. But you're saying you had a fast pack that you guys are doing in September, and you have a couple spots open. So What's that all about? Let's just give people some information here.
We are doing a fast packing trip in the Wind River Range in Wyoming, which is, one of the most gorgeous places in the United States. And so the trip is September 6th through September 12th. And so if you are a veteran and you'd like to come on this trip, go ahead and contact me through the website, because we've had a couple spots open up on it. And the reason that we do this trip is so that people gain the skills to take care of themselves well when they're trail running in the mountains or other kind of challenging environments, And so we'll do, like all the basics of like how you can be comfortable in the out of doors, basically. And also like how to, kind of camp before races. And so that you don't have to spend a lot of money on hotels and things like that. If you're going to camp before a race, like here's how to do it comfortably and well. And if you want to get into fast packing, here are the basics of doing that as well. And so my buddy Jake Fried, and I guide that trip, and he's exceptional. So if it's of
Awesome.
interest, please get in contact.
Yes, reach out. Liza, as always, so fun talking and catch up and hang out a little bit. So hopefully this help people realize like these big goals are big for everybody, not just people like you and Pam who've been doing this for a while and have competed at a high level. It's big for anybody who sets their mind to it. And that could be the 5K next weekend for somebody who's never done a 5K. And it could be a 100 miler for somebody who's never done that. And it kind of reaches everybody in between. So thanks for sharing your story, and it's always inspiring. And hopefully, you can get some more people involved with Band of Runners because it's an awesome organization. So, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Scott.